I'm going to talk about two big trends in American life over the last 50 or 60 years, the decline of institutional Christianity and the growing polarization of our politics.
Ross Douthat of the New York Times talking about his presentation at the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
The increasingly strident division between an ideological left and an ideological right. And I'm going to argue that Christianity has weakened precisely because people have become more likely to identify with ideologies than with religious beliefs, and that a recovered Christianity, a more robust public religious faith, is actually an answer to polarization because it gives people an identity that's bigger than partisanship, so they can define themselves as Christians first and liberals or conservatives second.
You can meet and hear Ross Douthat at the Issues Etc. Making the Case conference, June 7th and 8th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. The United Methodist Church was all in the news last month. They held their general conference, a special general conference, in St. Louis. The media was there because the question was of whether or not the United Methodist Church would continue to go essentially the way of the world on the issue of the LGBTQ agenda. Would they have gay clergy and would they permit gay marriage? And they decided not to. Now, there's another story that's brewing in the background with regard to the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church, possibly some full fellowship there. But does that make sense? As much sense? Since the United Methodist Church decided to turn away from the direction that the Episcopal Church has been going for decades and decades. Welcome back to Issues Etc. Joining us to talk about media coverage of a proposed full fellowship between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church, Terry Mattingly. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So it was big news, national news, perhaps even international news, the General Conference of the United Methodist Church last month. What does the media need to do now to follow up on that? Is there anything newsworthy after that big decision?
Yeah, there are several things that have happened and continue to happen that are certainly newsworthy. One is there's no sign that the kind of left-of-center church establishment of the United Methodist Church has given up the fight to hang on to its denomination. I guess the big symbolic moment was when the New York Times ran a kind of interesting and uniquely, strangely sourced story, noting that there were four Africans who may have voted in the election as delegates on the, all of these crucial issues. They may have voted when they were not qualified to do so. Now, what the Times played down was the fact that there were 30 African delegates who were supposed to be on the floor of that conference but couldn't get visas into the United States out of Africa to be there. So the Global South Coalition was actually even bigger than it showed up in the votes because they were down 30 votes. And there appear to have been controversies where people who were like substitute delegates may have voted when they weren't qualified. From a journalism perspective, though, the strangest part of the whole story was that some of the crucial information came from an African, but it was an African living in America who had served as a translator, and this was an African who was in favor of the compromise plan on doctrine, not the traditional plan. So this was kind of from an African perspective. This was a person who was compromised by his kind of loyalty to the American establishment. And not only did the Times quote him, the Times used that person as a source for second-hand quotes from conservatives. Conservatives who weren't quoted, and they accepted the word of this other person. So you had all this strange stuff. All of that is to say there definitely is a story about whether or not the institutional liberal side of the United Methodist Church has decided whether to come to the bargaining table and try to negotiate some kind of a split in the denomination. So that's number one. The number two, of course, is all of this stuff is going to come up again in Minneapolis in 2020, because this was a special general conference, which means the normal general conference is just right ahead of us, a year away. So a lot of these issues will be voted on again. Something that our listeners should look for if they're following the coverage is, because of membership trends, the Church of Africa and the Third World will have another 20 new delegates that will be taken away from the North American delegation because of continuing shifts in membership. The United Methodist Church apportions the votes in the conference based on membership. The African churches are growing. The American church is shrinking, especially in its most liberal locations across the Northeast, Upper Midwest, and the West Coast. Let's say they get the visa issues worked out. That means that going into the next meeting in Minneapolis, the Third World Coalition is going to have another 50 votes on its hands. And they were already winning all of these votes by fairly comfortable margins of 40, 50, 60 or so, as it was. So there's that. The third thing, which I wrote my column about this week, now this is way off in the future, but I think it's very important, and I'd be interested in knowing your feelings about this, because as you probably have had to tell reporters several times during your life, the word Lutheran applies to some very different groups of people. Can I get an amen?
Yes, you can. Amen.
Okay. So what potentially could happen on the Protestant left if you had large numbers of United Methodists who end up leaving their church or coming out of a divorce situation where they are able to leave with seminaries, with maybe a church agency or two, and maybe 50% or 40% of the trust funds, etc., all of a sudden, I can think of some other churches in American Protestant life that have bishops and have structures fairly similar to the United Methodist Church. Could we be watching the very first falling dominoes in the creation of something that would resemble the United Church of Canada, which would be an interdenominational liberal Protestant church, combining, just thinking out loud, picking churches with bishops, the Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church, and the ELCA. Now, the ELCA already has full communion concordance with the Episcopal Church, all the way down to interchangeable clergy under some circumstances. Also in 2020, and this is what my column was about, there is already a document on the table to be considered by the United Methodists on reaching a full communion agreement with the Episcopal Church. So all of a sudden, you would have the Methodists in communion with the Episcopalians, and the Episcopalians in communion with the other group of Lutherans. You can kind of see where I'm going with this. That is not merger of their churches. But at some point, especially as their numbers continue to decline and their resources fade, could you see them sharing seminaries? Could you see them having a few common bureaucracies, publishing houses? And maybe eventually, do we have serious talk about creating what would amount to a liberal Protestant superchurch? If that were to happen, that would be a huge story.
The proposed full fellowship between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church made more sense when the United Methodist Church's left thought they could get the one church plan passed, in which essentially every congregation did what was right in their own eyes on the issue of gay marriage and gay clergy, because, of course, the Episcopal Church has been leading the way when it comes to those issues already. That made more sense. Now that the traditional plan was passed last month, does it make as much sense?
Well, except you have to look at it this way. If the traditional plan creates a church in which the liberal United Methodists do not want to remain a part of that body, then that puts them searching for a new home or new partners. And would it make sense if they're going to form a new liberal United Methodist Church, might they consider forming that in conjunction with the Episcopalians or the ELC? You see what I'm getting at?
Oh, certainly.
Why create another small splinter church when some people might consider saying, why don't we create a bigger tent? So they would have a motivation to go hunting for another home, and that motivation is the traditional people winning in their denomination. If they had won with the One Church plan, you wouldn't have seen liberal Methodists leaving. You would have seen conservative Methodists leaving. And they would have been then looking for partners among other Wesleyan bodies, conservative Methodist churches in other parts of the Third World. I mean, you know, that would have been a completely different situation. And the left would still completely control the structure of the United Methodist Church in America. I've argued, you know, you and I have talked about this before. I've said all along, even before the St. Louis meeting, the only vote that mattered was whether they voted to allow churches to leave with their property and their financial resources, and ministers to be able to leave with access to their pension funds. Because if that happened, then you're going to have a divorce, because people are going to be able to leave while keeping their money and their church buildings, etc. That's what intrigues me. If the conservatives have won, they're going to continue to have more and more votes at General Conference. At what point does the left begin to look around and say, what's our best option for the future? I'm genuinely intrigued with a United Church of Canada approach. And theologically, it wouldn't be as complicated as attempting to create a... I mean, the United Church of Canada is a blending of Arminian, Wesleyan people with Calvinists. How do you get them in the same church? That's a more complicated theological situation, I think, than trying to get Episcopalians and Methodists to talk, because they're both off different trunks off the Church of England. They have a lot of common church history. And then the ELCA Lutherans have already shown a willingness to share clergy with the Episcopal Church, so they're already halfway there in terms of history. So it's intriguing to think about.
What I find curious about this is that church bodies are very complicated things, just as organizations. But there are factors that play in here. Theology is, I think, ought to be the biggest, but it's often the least considered matter when it comes to these full fellowship agreements. They just agree to disagree, essentially. Always when these things are being considered, the bigger sticking points are polity. Okay, what do you mean when you say bishop, and what do we mean when we say bishop? And then financial. Do I get to keep my pension plan, or can I go back and forth? And then perhaps there's also a cultural aspect to it as well, because you mentioned the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, largely kind of coming out of Northern European and really Scandinavian kind of culture, very pietistic, doesn't mix and play well with others, except on paper, but they still are very ecumenical. Which is the biggest sticking point of this kind of a thing for the UMC and for the Episcopal Church?
Yeah, when you talk about creating an organic merger, a new church, just stop and think about it. You're creating a new church tradition by merging different church traditions, different ethnic backgrounds, all the things you just mentioned. Well, that's really complicated. What you might see is something like a three-way concordat, kind of like the ELCA has with the Episcopal Church, which is where ministers are interchangeable. I mean, it's my understanding that not just that an ELCA pastor can lead a Eucharist at the altar of a Episcopal Church and have it be considered a valid sacrament, even though they haven't worked out their competing difference of a historic episcopate yet. But they've already done this communion concordant, and that's essentially what's already being considered between the Methodists and the Episcopalians. Now, there are now in America church buildings that on their front sign it says, you know, Our Savior Church, a parish of the ELCA Church and the Episcopal Church. To where you have one building that is now owned and operated by clergy that have standing in both of those denominations. That's not full organic unity, but that's like another step further along the way. And that's the sort of thing that could start happening once your clergy are interchangeable. Could 10 years from now, could you see a urban, kind of gay-friendly, liberal parish that says, you know, St. Aslam's Parish, a joint congregation of the Episcopal Church and the Free Methodist Union, or whatever that church would end up being called? Is that a possibility? It's already happening with the ELCA and the Episcopalians. Could that then happen with the Episcopalians and the Methodist? And then what happens if someone says, well, okay, we've got three struggling churches in this one city. Why don't we have one church with one building that now, since we're all in intercommunion, why don't we have one building for the Methodists, the ELCA Lutherans, and the Episcopalians? Hey, we'll just have a wider variety of Christmas cookies and hymns.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of a proposed full fellowship between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church. When we come back, one of those churches is truly global. The other one only likes to think of itself as global. We'll get to that with Terry next.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
It's time to register to vote for President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Each congregation or multi-point parish must register their pastor and lay voter with the LCMS Office of Secretary by Sunday, March 24th of 2019. A registration form has been mailed to every LCMS congregation. Learn more at issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident. issuesetc.org/LCMSPresident.
The difference between being in the world and being of the world finally comes down to being in Christ. However they live, whatever they do, wherever they go, Christians are in Christ. These words from the Reverend Dr. Joel Bierman perfectly encapsulate the March issue of The Lutheran Witness. Life together, set apart. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness. Interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
The Classical Liberal Studies major at Concordia University Chicago challenges you, through rigorous coursework, to connect history and innovation, applying classical concepts to a contemporary setting. Adding a minor in classical pedagogy will equip you to teach in classical schools and homeschools, drawing on Concordia Chicago's rich Lutheran heritage in the liberal arts. Learn more and apply now at cuchicago.edu.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Peace Lutheran, Fresno, California. Emmanuel Lutheran, Pensacola, Florida. St. Paul Lutheran, Council Bluffs, Iowa. Bethany Lutheran, Fairview Heights, Illinois. Zion Lutheran, Accident, Maryland. Ascension of Christ Lutheran, Beverly Hills, Michigan. Trinity Lutheran, Louisville, Minnesota. Village Lutheran, Ladue, Missouri. Prince of Peace Lutheran, Freedom, Pennsylvania. Bethel Lutheran, Ballinger, Texas. Zion Lutheran, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. And Messiah Lutheran, Marysville, Washington. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at the website, and in the Issues Etc. Journal. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. on this Thursday, March the 21st. We're talking with Terry Mattingly of the On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate about media coverage of a proposed full fellowship agreement between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church. Terry, when she was still presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, I had the opportunity to interview Catherine Jeffords Shorey, and at some point in the conversation, she bristled at the fact that I was referring to her church body as the Episcopal Church USA. She insisted that her church body was a global church body. Now, in the marriage or the proposed marriage between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church USA, the United Methodist Church is truly a global church body. I'm not so sure about the Episcopal Church.
Well, what she meant is that there are some missionary dioceses that still remain attached to the Episcopal Church in the United States. Okay? That's what she meant, whether she wanted to be honest about it or not. That is not the same thing as the true organic unity in power structures and everything else that exist within the United Methodist Church. And if a liberal superchurch emerges, I don't expect it to have much of an international quality at all, because that's where in all of these different battles within the Anglican Communion, for example, the exact same split and dichotomy between the third world conservatives and the European and North American progressive slash liberals, you see that in all of these different churches. You even see that in the Roman Catholic Church right now, you know, between the more conservative Catholic bishops of Africa and the liberal bishops of Germany and, to some extent, the United States. So once again, if a super church emerges, I'm saying it looks to me that the patterns are forming it for to emerge on the doctrinal left, and that if that happens, you're talking maybe some sort of shared life between Europe and America, but you're not talking about the rest of the world, because the rest of the world is, frankly, more doctrinally conservative.
The Episcopal Church also is still ostensibly a member of the Anglican Communion.
Yeah.
Does that present a problem for a proposed full fellowship between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church?
No, it shouldn't. It would be settling only for things for churches that are legally tied to that U.S. Episcopal Church body or the United Methodist Church. But remember, I don't think right now that there's any incentive for intercommunion between the Methodist and the Episcopalians if that were to include the conservative Methodists. I mean, they don't want any part of that. I'm saying that that may go onto the back burner until we know what happens to the liberal half, or more than half, of the U.S. Methodist flock. I mean, because you've seen poll data, I had it in one of my recent columns, that claimed that 60% of United Methodists in America are already okay with some kind of liberalizing on sexuality issues, especially homosexuality and gay marriage, that at the very least they're split 50-50, or they might even be split 60% liberal to 40% conservative, but they're losing the votes because of Africa and parts of Europe and Asia.
Is it too early for the media to be paying attention to this proposed full fellowship agreement?
I don't think it's too early to talk about it. Now, I ended my column this week with a funny quote where this Episcopal minister, who's very active in interfaith and ecumenical efforts, and he had written an interesting essay, which is what caught my attention, on how Episcopalians should greet any Methodists who show up at their doors. What to do with Methodists who feel driven out of their own church? How should you deal with them right now? And he had a one-liner. He says, right at the moment, we have enough financial resources that we have the luxury of separate church structures in America. Now, flip that around. What he was saying is, I mean, the United Methodist Church has lost 40% of its U.S. membership, and the Episcopal Church has lost half or more of their membership since the mid-60s. These are churches that have major demographic and numerical problems. He was saying at some point in the future, we might have a financial incentive to seek a common financial structure. But then he laughed kind of and said, yeah, but we may pull off some sort of merger, but I don't know if we'll ever be able to merge our pension plans. And that gets you back to kind of the graveyard humor that you were talking about earlier, that it might be easier to come up with a common approach to theology or a common view of the creed than it is to work out the pension plan. When dollars and cents come into play, people tend to get very human over how those sorts of financial arrangements are made. Merge, I can't think of anything much more complicated than merging two religious denominations. When you look at property law, you look at tax status, you look at all of those different things, all their agencies, all of the schools, just think of all the things that would be involved in that. But at some point, it might make financial sense as well as emerging theological sense. And I think it's perfectly valid for reporters to go ahead and start thinking about that. And I predict you'll now see some stories ahead of the Minneapolis gathering next year that focus on this agreement with the Episcopalians and whether it's dead in the water because of the conservative victories. I think you'll see some people pick up on that when we get closer to that date.
Why is it essential for the media to talk not only with, say, a bishop or two from both of these church bodies, but also to talk with the rank-and-file membership as well, from which I imagine they might get two very different opinions about full fellowship?
Well, I could see that going both ways. I mean, because there are cities in America where, let's say, where the Methodists have been, from their theological perspective, especially courageous on gay and lesbian issues. I would predict they already have some working partnerships with local Episcopal churches. I bet you they're already doing some forms of social action and political witness together. So I think that in certain parts of America, these networks may already have started to form. This Episcopal priest at one point said, Episcopalians shouldn't gloat over the fact that they're ahead of the Methodist on gay issues. He said, because to be honest with you, no matter what the Methodist discipline says, there are United Methodist congregations that are more liberal on sexuality than most of the Episcopal Church. So never forget that what happens in San Francisco is not the same thing as what happens in Dallas. What happens in New York City or Boston is not the same thing that happens in Atlanta or Nashville. You know, you see what I'm saying? These churches tend to have different theological and cultural expressions in different parts of the country. So we may have people who want to start talking union really quick in some parts of the country and not so much in the other, and that just becomes another complicating factor in the story.
So what kind of questions, if the media begins to inquire now, what kind of questions do they need to be asking, in particular, of this kind of, there's, I'm not saying upheaval in the United Methodist Church, but there's discontent in the United Methodist Church.
Oh, there's an upheaval is on its way, one way or the other. I think, to anticipate your question, I think that reporters do have to start asking the leaders on the Methodist left, what's the line that has to get crossed before you're ready to leave? What finally puts the left at the negotiating table? Which leads me to a great old Episcopal joke. Now, this is one, looking at it from a conservative point, because in the Episcopal Church, it's the conservatives have been losing. And there's this famous conservative Episcopal seminary called Neshota House. And the way I heard the joke is two Neshota House graduates are standing in the back of the National Cathedral when the presiding bishop and her lesbian lover begin a liturgical procession down the center aisle carrying a statue of the Buddha. Okay? Woman, presiding bishop, her lesbian lover carrying a statue of the Buddha down the center aisle of the National Cathedral. One Neshota House graduate turns to the other and says, you know, one more thing and I'm out of here. It's really hard to cut the ties that bind. And so, in effect, I'm thinking flip that joke around and look at it from a liberal, gay rights, United Methodist perspective. At what point do you have an African bishop with his wife, with his hands raised in the air in charismatic prayer, doing an altar call in a major Methodist church, and one gay Methodist turns to the other and says, you know, one more thing and I'm out of here? What's the line that has to be crossed that is going to make life unacceptable to the United Methodist left, and how close are we to it? I think that's the valid story to start asking if you're a secular reporter.
We're talking about media coverage of a proposed full fellowship between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church. Terry Mattingly is our guest, founder and editor of Get Religion. You have 10 days left to take advantage of the early bird registration fee of $150 for the one and only 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. It's your opportunity to meet and hear Ross Douthat of the New York Times, Pastor Hans Feeney of Lutheran Satire, Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine, LCMS President Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith of National Review, and LCMS Worship Director Will Whedon. Attendance is limited to 500. Thanks to the Lutheran Church Extension Fund sponsorship, childcare is absolutely free for children ages 1 through 12. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th in Chicago. Well, Terry mentioned the dwindling numbers of both of these church bodies, but the United Methodist Church is considerably larger than the Episcopal Church USA, and the Episcopal Church doesn't have much to lose. Its margins are much, much thinner. We'll talk about that after this.
I'm delighted to be chairman of Preach the Word Project, a project of our synod to strengthen the preaching of all of us pastors in the synod. We know how eternally important that is.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Carl Fekencher talking about the new Preach the Word Project.
So we've put together a program of 12 modules that will be coming out this year and over the next 3 years on a variety of preaching topics for pastors to do together with two other pastors, two guys they trust, two guys they feel comfortable with, written materials and very fine video quality materials that are now becoming available.
Preach the Word helps pastors work together to improve their preaching with several resources and by interacting with seminary professors and fellow preachers. Find out more at lcms.org/preachtheword. lcms.org/preachtheword. Preaching is challenging business. We all can use some fresh ideas. lcms.org/preachtheword.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Emmanuel Press is a Lutheran-owned business in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in operation since 2004. That's 15 years of publishing liturgical and devotional books, 15 years of collaborating with Lutheran authors, artists, and translators. Thanks to our loyal customers and Issues Etc., we look forward to many more years of confessing and teaching the Christian faith. Visit us online at emmanuelpress.us. E-M-M-A-N-U-E-L press.us.
My kind of town, Chicago is...
The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Terry Mattingly is our guest, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. We're talking about media coverage of a proposed full fellowship agreement between the United Methodist Church and the Episcopal Church. A few minutes ago, you had mentioned their dwindling numbers. Both of these church bodies, in terms of percentage, have lost a lot of members, but the United Methodist Church still has a huge margin, and the Episcopal Church's margins of what they, well, they don't have much left to lose, is considerably thinner.
Yeah. And how will that sort out under Methodist polity? The answer is I don't know. But don't forget that the traditional plan opened up the possibility of allowing entire general conferences to leave together. The Methodist traditionalists have been much more flexible in talking to the left than the left has been talking to the right in the past.
But numbers also means money.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, does a reporter need to dig into the financials of a church body like the Episcopal Church USA and ask the question, are you eventually going to have to merge with somebody just to survive?
And that's what that minister was saying. He said, right now, we have the luxury of separate structures. And I took that as an implication. At some point in the future, we may not have the luxury of separate structures. Now, the Episcopal Church has trust funds, and it has extremely expensive land in a number of places. But don't forget, the Episcopal Church has sold off a bunch of very valuable land in New York City to help keep its doors open and its national offices to pay the bills. You're absolutely right about that, and that's a maybe a pushy but a very valid line of inquiry. And reporters like to talk about money and numbers, or they at least they should be willing to talk about that. So that's a part of it. But right now, I think it's more of an emotional story. The United Methodist Church, a lot of its ministers, especially gay and lesbian clergy and their supporters, they're hurting. And when people are hurting, they have to start thinking, where is this going to go in the future? And so I think the key question is, what would cause them to say, one more thing, and I'm out of here? I think that's the emotional story right now, which is where we are.
Are we talking about a story, the reshaping of mainline Protestant America, in a sense, that the traditional seven sisters might dwindle to or merge into the five sisters or something like that?
Well, yeah, we're already, I would argue that the declining numbers of the liberal mainline churches has already created a massive hole in the American public arena of discourse that the religious right and evangelicalism has largely filled, whether the press wants to admit it or not. As the mainline church continues to decline, you know, they're saying they may rearrange the chairs on the Titanic, but the simple fact of the matter is that some of them, if they pooled their resources, might be able to build a pretty nice liner for a while. And I'm even willing to concede that in a liberalizing American culture, we may hit a moment where a liberal church may stabilize in terms of membership, and maybe even in some parts of the United States might even grow a little bit once it falls down to a certain demographic level. But, you know, it's kind of hard to stay the same unless you have children, converts, and other people that help keep that thing going. But we're entering a very interesting period of time, and I think reporters should care what's happening on the Protestant left. They should care about it and get ready to write more stories about it, because this is going to get complex, interesting, and emotional.
How many more decades does that story have? I guess I'm kind of asking, if I'm a new graduate from a J school, and I anticipate being gainfully employed for the next 40 years, at the end of my career, will I still be talking about mainline Protestantism?
Well, yes, I think you will, because I think there will be some liberal form of Christianity in America, no matter what. I don't see that going away, because there's a large number of people in America who are kind of morally, culturally, and politically liberal, and I think they'll want pews. At least some of them will. The question is, how fast is this going to happen? And don't forget that simply from the viewpoint of gray hair and elderly people sitting in pews, the mainline churches are way older than their evangelical and charismatic equivalents. And a lot of those people are going to start vanishing. And they're facing a kind of a demographic cliff here within the next 10 years, 15 at the most. So I think we're going to see some sort of resolution on this within about a decade.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thanks for your time.
Glad to talk to you.
I know that many of you are familiar with the work of the Lutheran Women's Missionary League. Well, during March, if you open a Lutheran Federal Credit Union loan to meet your financial needs, or if you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give the same amount of money to the LWML. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran Federal Credit Union, good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org. In hour two of Issues Etc. on this Thursday afternoon, Dr. Jesse Yao will join us. We'll talk about the teachings and practices of Jehovah's Witnesses. Then we'll get to listener email and the Issues Etc. comment line.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Have you considered homeschooling your children, but wondered if you have the time or the expertise? If you live in the St. Louis Metro East, check out St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. We offer a classical Lutheran education for children pre-kindergarten through eighth grade. St. Paul Lutheran School is located just off of Interstate 55 in Hamel. Learn more at school.stpaulhamel.org. St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois. school.stpaulhamel.org.
The living God is now defined by the living and risen Christ.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Do not fall away from the true God who died and rose again and lives for you.
Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.
Hey Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore, thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.